For many years now, Holden Village has joined with the rest of the world in celebrating Gay and Lesbian Pride Week, which is why we're having this forum, which is simply entitled Telling Our Stories, Gay and Lesbian Christians. We have a little panel here with whom I'll introduce in a second. I'm Dan Gesslin, the program coordinator here in the village. Our usual way of doing a forum is to do them for exactly an hour, so I'll be watching the time, and that allows everyone who wants to move on in an hour to do that and have a time to gracefully exit. And then if there are people who want to stay and continue talking, we can do that. But at an hour from the point we start, I'll call time. Because an hour isn't very long, what our format is going to be this evening is just to have four real brief sharing periods of a couple minutes of self-introduction, and then we'll just open it up. And there's never people afraid to talk at Holden, so we're just trusting that we'll fill our hour. We want to allow as many voices to speak as possible, so let's all try to keep our comments short. One little ground rule we have in Holden forums is we try to speak for ourselves, not for other people, and we try to do not attack, or what sometimes is called cross-talking, but rather just share our feelings or thoughts and respect each other's points of view, whatever they might be. So I'm going to give these young people a break and be the first one to go. Besides being the program coordinator here, which I've been doing for a year now, and John and my partner John and I will be here through the summer and then moving on in the fall. I'm also an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ, which has been ordaining openly gay and lesbian people, even ones in relationships, since 1972. And in case you're unfamiliar, the United Church of Christ is the tradition of the Pilgrims in Plymouth Rock in 1620. And sort of the way that every Lutheran, I was brought up Lutheran, knows that we are saved by grace through faith alone. In the UCC, people are brought up saying that the gospel is perceived and expressed through social justice. The gospel is perceived and expressed through social justice. So the Congregationalists, as we used to be called, ordained the first African American in 1785. Lemuel Haynes, the first woman in Christian history, in 1853, Antoinette Brown, and the first openly gay person in modern history, Bill Johnson, in 1972. I grew up Lutheran in Minnesota, went to St. Olaf College and Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary in Berkeley, and halfway through that process, told my bishop that I was gay, and he responded, as was being done in those days, this is way back in 1977, by presenting me with a contract that stated that which I was supposed to sign, that said I could be ordained if I never told anyone I was gay and lived a life of celibacy. And that did not seem Lutheran to me, since part of the Reformation was affirmation of our whole selves, and that we're not saved through the work of celibacy, but by faith, through faith, by grace alone. So I said no and went back to the seminary, and that was during Easter vacation, and felt very depressed and angry with God and the church, and wondered what would happen to me and why God had taken me on this journey. It seemed like the end of the world. And the Reverend Dr. Wally Stewart, who was president of the seminary at that time, said, "Well, we hate to lose you, but under the circumstances, why don't you look at the United Church of Christ," which I did, and they accepted me, to make a long story short. And I was ordained in 1983. My first job, that was right at the moment when that AIDS pandemic was hitting. And I knew some people and was in the right place at the right time and became the first chaplain on the San Francisco General Hospital AIDS ward, which I did for 5 years. Then my mother was diagnosed with a brain tumor and given a year to live. So I went home to Minnesota because my dad had a heart attack while doing caregiving for her. So I went home to be of help. And didn't know exactly what I was going to do, but as I came back to the Twin Cities, became aware of what a deep need there was among gay and lesbian people in the Twin Cities to have a place to worship. And so I started Spirit of the Lakes, United Church of Christ, which was the first predominantly gay and lesbian congregation in the United Church of Christ or any other denomination, served there until I was called in 1993 by the UCC to start a similar church in Cleveland, which is where our national headquarters are, which I did for 7 years until coming here a year ago to take a break from gay and lesbian stuff. And with that, I'll move on to Mike, who's sort of the head honcho of our minors and junior minors program this summer.
Okay. Yeah, because like you said, my name's Mike. I'm here for the summer on short-term staff. And my story's not quite as long. I'm only 20. But I guess I'm 20 years old. I've only been out for about 5 months since January, when I actually came to Holden Village for a class through my school. I go to PLU in Tacoma, and I came to Holden knowing that it was affirming of gay and lesbians, and hoping that that would help me to become more comfortable with it, and eventually to be able to come out to my friends and my family and such. I guess some history, sort of. I wasn't raised as a Christian, but my family still wasn't like affirming of homosexuality, and I can remember as far back as being like 10 or 11 years old and just kind of feeling like I was different. And I remember one night my mom was watching some documentary on TV about homosexuality, and I related to it, and I felt like that's what I was, but all my mom had to say about it were derogatory comments, and pretty much from that point on, and all through high school, that sort of really had me scared, and really had me in denial, and trying to, like, think that I could change who I was, and just to fit in with what my mom, with the ideas I got from my mom. And then when I went to college, I started to become a little bit more comfortable with it, just kind of being in a different atmosphere, meeting other gay people, and realizing that, you know, life for them wasn't wrong or really terrible. So then I came to Fulton in January, and just kind of the atmosphere of the place and people that I met really just drastically changed my life, and I just decided that it was time to come out and to be proud of who I was. And while I was here, I kept a journal. I want to read a few things out of it because I think that's the best way for me to kind of express like how it felt and what I went through. So, here goes. All of a sudden, I realized that this was potentially the greatest opportunity of my life. This was one of the reasons I had come to Holden for and had hoped to leave feeling more comfortable with, this thing, the fact that I'm gay. I feel like this is a miracle. Whether by God or something else, I have been reborn today. Everything seems so clear and easy now, although I'm sure it won't be. However, I do feel like a huge weight has been lifted off my shoulders, and my actual life is about to begin. What a magnificent feeling. And here I am, on the verge of one of the most significant breakthroughs of my life, young life, and the world has stayed the same. It has not ceased to exist as I had feared. In fact, everything now takes on a new sense of majesty. I only hope that when I wake up in the morning, I feel the same way as I do right now. Liberated, loved, beautiful, and oh so free and happy. The world could not seem a better place at this moment. I pray that it will only become more spectacular. I really think my prayers have been answered. I have been looking for a sign from God to help me define my beliefs and spirituality, and this very well could be it.
Next is Lisa, who is working in media ministry.
All right. Well, I'm 34, and I came out to my parents 13 years ago. But it's been a coming out from my orientation and a coming out from my spirituality. My parents raised me Catholic, and it was a very rigid home environment. I still to this day cannot ever recall my parents showing any affection in front of me, holding hands, kissing, snuggling, anything. And so it was very clear to me when I was growing up that, at least in their eyes, that was dangerous and that was something to be avoided or shunned or ashamed of. And so I feel like I grew up asexual because that wasn't allowed to be. And my mother left out a lot of religious literature. And growing up, I went to that to go beyond this world. I needed spirituality. I needed religion to go out of my body and to go beyond this world. So I became very, very religious. I read the four spiritual laws and gave my life to Christ and memorized Bible verses and pretty much felt that that was my identity through God. And then when I went to college, I realized that all my life I'd realized I was different, but I didn't know how, and I felt whatever was different about me was something wrong and something I should be ashamed of. But when I went to college, it was very clear to me that I had strong attachments to women. And I went to the college pastor at St. Olaf And I said, you know, I have these attachments to women and I really need help. And he said, well, do you think you're gay? And I'm like, no, I'm not gay. I'm just too attached. Can you just help me, you know, not be so freaked out by everything they do? So, you know, and I to this day, I just wonder what was going through his mind. But it was very clear that that was probably what was happening to me. And then a woman, the first woman that ever came out to me, she came out and, you know, kind of like your epiphany and feeling like all of a sudden the world had opened up to you. I just have this image of when she came out to me, all these butterflies just left me. It's this very real image that I have. And it was like somebody just needed to say the words. Not the pastor asking me, but somebody needed to say, I am a whole person, I'm living, you can touch me, you can see me, and this is who I am. And it was just like, I am too. And that was my moment when I realized that I was. But at that moment, I felt like I had to become aspiritual. I could not be both gay and spiritual. And so I stopped all my Bible studies. I stopped FCA at St. Olaf. I stopped doing any of that. And it's interesting because then my girlfriend at the time wanted me to go to Spirit of the Lakes because it was this new gay church that you can be both. And I remember going to the church and Dan was presiding and my first thought was, this is evil. This is so evil that these people think that they can be Christian and gay at the same time. And so for me, I had to choose. And I was choosing to be gay because, you know, there's a force of nature that you can't try to alter. But I could choose not to be Christian, it felt like. I could choose not to be spiritual. And so I kind of lopped that off from my life. And ever since then, I'll just be concise, it's been this walking around the circle and ending up back with my spirituality and with my body both intact. And I think it's going to be a lifelong struggle and a lifelong connection. I don't think I struggle so much as, you know, you have to live in the world and the world doesn't always help you along. So I have, through various means, kind of come back around and realized I can be both. I'm out to my parents, but they still think it's a problem. But they're really the only people in the world that matter to me that think that. So I feel very much embraced by what is true and what is real. So that's okay.
Thanks, Lisa. Next is Miriam, who serves the village as one of our kitchen coordinators.
I'm Miriam. Where to start? I was talking to Lisa before this. I'm like, gosh, it's been a while since I tried to tell a story in, you know, 2 minutes or something like that. But, okay, so Christianity and sexual identity. I was raised in New York City, in a really liberal inner city Lutheran church that was a mix of a lot of straight people and gay people. There were a lot of gay men in the congregation, but it wasn't a gay church. It was very much a church in New York City. There's a little bit of everybody there, though not many kids. That was what my church experience was like. My parents were, you know, I think they would have described themselves as pretty like liberal, modern, progressive people that had gay friends and certainly would have said, we are open to this. We see this as not a bad thing, as possibly even a good thing. Certainly, I was raised I consider myself extremely blessed to have been raised in a Christian identity that allowed for many different senses of sexuality. So that was kind of my Christian upbringing. I went to college, and another part of this, I hope this makes sense as I talk about it, one of the things I think that's most interesting about hearing a panel of people talk about their sexual identity and their spirituality is how we're all going to talk about this a little bit differently and a little bit similarly. And so, like the way that I would talk about my coming out is going to be different than how Mike is right now talking about his, or Dan talked about his, or Lisa talked about hers. We're all different ages, and I think that's great because words, different sets of languages, different social and cultural things have been happening even in the short span of the last 20 years. Like, so much has happened. And so I'm 25, and when I was 18, I went to college and I fell in love with a woman. And I was in love with a woman for maybe a year before I really thought much about sexual identity. I was in a relationship, and I think if you had asked me, I would have said, well, you know, I'm in a relationship with this woman. That seems right now. I haven't really felt the need to define myself as anything in particular. About a year after that relationship had begun, I did start to feel a need and a desire to define myself in a sexual category. I felt a desire to connect with a larger community, and kind of in that, you know, in it, probably about six or seven years ago now, came to a point where I understood myself as, I think for a while, understood myself as a bisexual woman. At some point said, well, no, what it seems to me is probably I'm going to be with a woman in my life. And that means by the language that I'm given by this culture, I'm going to find comfort in the identity of a lesbian. And that was a word that I took on and said, okay, I'm going to take this up. I'll carry this sign. Another word, and I want to throw these all out because I think they're great questions to talk about later, is another word that I've really embraced, and especially now in my life, embrace a lot, is the word queer. That has a lot to do with when I came out. I came out in the mid-90s. There was a reappropriation of the word queer among a very certain set of people who said, as people did, you know, maybe 20 or 30 years ago of the word gay, yeah, these people, those of us in the mid to late 90s said, wait a second, this word queer, what does this mean? This has been a word, as so many of these words, dyke, fag, queer, have been used to denigrate people. Even though this is a word that has been used to denigrate us, we're going to take that word back and we're going to use that. I like the word queer because what it seems to encompass for me is a confusion of our sexual categories. The fact, I don't believe that there are just people in the world that are attracted to, you know, that there are just women in the world attracted to women, and women in the world attracted to men, and men in the world attracted to men, and men in the world attracted to women. I feel like, yes, there are all of these categories, and there are so many more. And we are complicated people, and our genders and how sex plays into gender for all of us. It seems very interesting and complex. And that whole kind of beautiful differentiation for me is encompassed by the word queer. So I identify as a lesbian, I identify as a queer. Anyway, back to Christianity. 2 minutes, Dan, right? I think I felt extremely lucky when I came out because I thought I didn't have to go back to a Christianity that had shut me out. It was a Christianity that was open to me. But I think what I've struggled with in my life is to, as very much as what Lisa was talking about, bridge that gap in a very different way. I had a community of my gay and lesbian and queer friends, and I had a community of Christian friends, and they weren't necessarily the same community. And I often felt as weird about coming out as a Christian to my gay and lesbian friends as coming out as a queer to my Christian friends. Like it was just this equally hard things to do for me. And often my a group of gay and lesbian people would say, Christianity? Aren't you over that? You know, when aren't you over that? I often felt that even more difficult than, but I was raised in a very specific Christian context that I think allowed for my lesbianism. So here I am at Holden Village, and I feel like it's a great place for me to continue this integration of here I am. It's one of the first communities I worked at where I feel like my Christian identity and my queer identity can be in the same place. So that's where I am.
Well, our queer theory is that not just the four of us, but everyone is an expert. So we can share parts of our stories, or you can share parts of your stories, or ask questions of us, or just kind of get the conversation going. And for those who came in late, a quick reminder that we're called to respect all points of view in the forum, and we want to speak for ourselves, not for other people. And we'll try not to argue, but rather just speak up what's on our minds or hearts. And of course, we can inspire each other to speak, but hopefully not in an argumentative or abusive way, which certainly would not be the way of Christ.
That's right. I had a question for Miriam. You got me interested when you told me about your parents, and what was their reaction then when you talked to them about being lesbian and queer?
When I came out? Very interesting reaction. I felt like...
Or did you do that before me?
That was it right here. That's why it was a hard weekend. No, actually, luckily, years and years ago, I'm a terrible one for keeping secrets. I just have to tell people everything. And when I came out to my parents, I have four, so there were lots of coming out. And another person. And of course, coming out, of course, to some people, this makes so much sense. You never just come out. You keep coming out and again. And it's, when I first came out to them, my parents said, gosh, the gay men they know, they didn't really know lesbian women, or, you know, as close friends. The gay men we know, we think are unhappy. I was like, wow, what's that about? This is from my liberal parents. And I mean, this was said very subtly to me, but I think they were talking about men in their generation, the couple of men that they knew really well, maybe, who had struggled in the decades of their lives with sexuality and with coming out and with, and here I was, you know, 18. I was in a very liberal arts college on the East Coast. I felt pretty accepted. I felt like this was a good thing and a happy thing. And I was really angry at them for putting that on me to say that I would be, like, what are you trying to say? I'm not, this is not something to worry about. This is something that and of course it was a parent's fear for me. Like, we want you to be happy. Can you be happy if you're with a woman? So that was probably the beginning of it. I think there was a lot of love and acceptance there too. And my parents, the overarching wonderful story of it is I feel like I have kept pushing my parents to more and more levels of understanding me, and they have risen to each challenge that I have set them. And I bring my girlfriend home. We ask them, we have long discussions about who this person is to me and how they introduce this girlfriend to the rest of the people that are at the dinner table. Like, who is this to Miriam, you know? And, you know, different senses of how does my girlfriend play into the family situation when that girlfriend was a girlfriend of year after year, you know, when this is a significant relationship, how does that person in my life, my partner, play into the family relationship? So each year there was more and more challenges and my parents have risen to them. I feel extremely blessed. Yes.
That reminds me of a column one day in the newspaper, maybe in your hometown, in your newspaper, you have Miss Manners, who gives people advice on social situations, and someone had written in, they were so worried because it was a parent of the bride, and there was going to be this wedding, and the groom's brother was gay, and they had heard that he and his partner were coming, and they were so worried, and so they had written to Miss Manners. When they go through the reception line, what do we say? And Miss Manners wrote back, "How do you do?" Other questions?
I am a former bisexual lesbian. I'm not quite sure, but I think we're more lesbian than bisexual. And I came back to my spirituality and found out through study. At first, I felt that I was okay with both. But then through study, and I haven't done a whole lot. I probably should have done more. But I'm at a point in my life where sexual relationships are not a big thing for me. And I was just wondering how you reconcile some of the teaching in the Bible with your lifestyle.
I'm teaching a class next week for an hour a day. You're going to be here going through those things. I mean, that's a huge question. Yeah, all week. I would just say there, let's see. I kind of start with something Martin Luther said, which is the Bible holds the Word of God the way the manger held the Christ child. And so that's that is a different approach than some traditions take to Scripture. In the United Church of Christ, we say there's ever yet more new light and truth to break forth from God's holy word. So there are many things in the Bible. When we approach the Bible, part of what we bring is a particular cultural lens. And we get used to the way the culture around us interprets the Bible.
Into their culture.
I mean, there are many more passages in Scripture, for example, that support slavery. And part of what happened around the time of the American Civil War in our culture was an argument. And the Southern Methodists broke up from the Northern Methodists, and the Southern Baptists still to this day broke out from the American Baptists. Presbyterians split. The Lutherans decided to make no decision because it might divide the church. really, they did. But now we would never look, you know, how do we approach those passages in Scripture that say slaves remain subject to your master? We don't govern our culture that way. If we were following that, we would not have ordained women in the church, because women are supposed to be silent and they're not supposed to teach men according to Scripture. So all denominations to one degree or another, say, and if I recall my seminary days correctly, the Lutheran statement is, Jesus Christ is the measure of how we interpret Scripture. What does the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus tell us about any individual passage in Scripture we're talking about? And how does the Holy Spirit inform us now? So part of the discussion in the church at this time, and it's in all denominations, is the Spirit telling us a new thing about this issue the way it has before about slavery and women, or the world being flat, or, you know, there's many things. And that we want to stay in relationship to Scripture and take that seriously, but our understandings of God's will and God's love change, and we try to use the living word of God, which is Jesus Christ, to interpret.
I should probably rephrase something I said. I mean, I listened to everything you said, and it makes sense to me, but I realized that I sort of, I've been telling other people my story, and I sort of left out a big thing. What happened in my life is that I was so overcome by the love that God had for me that the only way I could see to reconcile it was to follow His law. That's what I meant to say. So as a response to that love, I felt it was only right that I should follow His law.
And I, for one, would respect your choice to do that. My experience of God's love has led me in a different path, which is, I would consider, ethical, but not the same as that. And if one of our other distinguished panelists, Lisa, you talked about this four spiritual laws.
Yeah, I was thinking when you asked your original question, even though that's not the one you want to stick with, but,
well,
I don't really...
Stick with it, but
yeah, I don't...
Just clarify. Sorry.
For me personally, I don't even try to answer the question, does God think it's okay to be gay or straight? Because, I don't know, there's a lot of questions I can't answer. But I know love, and I know grace.
Oh, I still believe that God love me and accept me and have grace for me. It was just a personal response to that love.
Yeah, and that's so much of what I think Miriam's talking about. You know, we are all somewhere. We can't put ourselves into boxes, and if you can live your life with greatest integrity, living as you live, so be it, and you should shine like anyone else. And so that's where I kind of go away from trying to get the answers, because whatever my answers are, whatever your answers are, there's still a truth, and someday I trust we'll know it. And like I said, I do know enough of the truths of the elemental things that make me human and make me spiritual that I just have to trust that and live my life with integrity too, but always trying to reconcile almost every act I do with being my full self, and that doesn't get too technical.
I'm going to put on my moderator's hat and say, you know, we need to kind of keep going for our hour, and if someone says something that you'd like to follow through with, you know, check in with that person at the end of the hour. Yes.
I have a question about the identity issue. I came back early from a hike the other day because I wanted to catch some of the rally, and I just missed it, but I did have a chance to go around and peruse some of the signs and saw the ones in the ice cream shop now that has to do with sexuality as an identity, not a preference. So where it talks about, you know, ice cream flavors, a preference and this sort of thing. And when you were telling your story, you talked about your sort of search for an identity and your need or desire to sort of have a way to classify yourself. And then yet, I guess, is it Lisa?
Yeah.
You just said something about putting ourselves in boxes. And to me, those two things at times seem kind of contradictory. And I wonder if you guys as a group, or individually at least, could respond to the question, do you think that our society and its sort of this sort of oppressive intolerance of people of different varying types of sexuality create some of that need to define ourselves, our sexuality, in terms of our identity? Sandra Bem, a very prominent psychologist, once talked about her sexuality and said, you know, I'm not gay, I'm not straight, I'm not bisexual, I am attracted to people. And what she concluded was that the thing that attracted her to people was independent of the sex of partner dimension. There was characteristics of people. And sometimes those characteristics were in men, sometimes they were in women. And so she thinks of herself as not gay, straight, lesbian, whatever, but a person who has erotic attractions that are sometimes directed toward men and sometimes toward women. And I wonder if some of that need to classify is built out of that oppressive sort of intolerance. If people didn't go around labeling other people, then would people need to assume those labels in some way or another?
I think that's a great question. And that's one side of it. Yeah, I think labels in our culture can act in ways that limit people. I also think there is this deep human need that we have to be a part of something bigger than us. We ask for those labels. We ask for those categories of identity because, God, you know, you wake up in the morning and what's going to happen? You know, you don't know. We never know what's going to happen. And it can be chaotic and life can be just so uncertain. And so in that, gosh, it's somehow, you know, I think it's, you know, driven, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I don't think it's driven only by this kind of terrible societal labeling, you know, the kind of like linked to all of those bad things, like, you know, hierarchical, patriarchal, all these things that we say that are, you know, is bad about our society. I think that it's also out of just this deep need. And I think that it's a really interesting question and why I kind of talk about sexuality in the way that I do. I think that different people have different needs to categorize themselves. It has been deeply important to me at some times to be a part of pride, to be a part of a parade, and to hold a sign that's pretty explicit, and to be like, to be out there and to say, okay, here I am, and I am categorizing myself as a lesbian here. There are times where that need is just not there. Like I just want to be, it doesn't matter to me what people think, if they're thinking that I'm straight or a lesbian or bisexual or whatever. Like, I'm just talking to them and we're having a conversation, and that category of identity doesn't matter. So, I don't know, more people.
I think there's also, there has been an historical political need for categorizations that as that movement becomes successful, the need gradually dissipates. But it's also, this is part of, this difference between how Miriam and I naturally tell our story is also the difference between modern and postmodern. And part of my concern as someone who loves the Church of Jesus Christ is that the Church is struggling with a modern issue, and we're already in a postmodern age.
and more and increasingly a post-Christian age. And maybe that's the way history always works. I mean, as Miriam was talking, I was thinking for some reason of Abraham Lincoln wanting to give all the freed slaves 40 acres and a mule. And I think of that sometimes in terms of the racial tensions that still exist in our culture. And, you know, we had this chance in the beginning to work toward equity, and now so often it just seems like it's so far gone. You know, can we ever solve this problem, how big it is now? There's some kind of parallels here. While the church is struggling with the issues that were brought up in 1969 in the Stonewall Rebellion, a whole generation has grown up, many of them outside the church, in a society that, I mean, I just hate the fact that most people, especially most young people in the United States today, look at Christianity and the church as the oppressive force in our society, you know, the thing that holds people back from human wholeness and from not only political but spiritual liberation. I mean, what a sad thing, and what are we doing as the people who are responsible for the church and giving it on to the next generation? That's my bigger concern than whether or not gay people can be ordained, is there's a whole generation that do not look at this as an issue. I mean, the MTV generation does not look at this as an issue. It's like, what are they arguing about? And how do we minister in that generation? Is it through, can we impose those laws anymore? Or meanwhile, the rest of society, there still is engaged in a great ethical, it's not that our society is abandoning ethics, but the ethics of sexuality are changing and are no longer defined by gender, but are defined by vulnerability, and exploitation, not what is that old line about, you know, which orifice, but rather exploitation, and the line is between exploitation and consenting adults, to make it easy. But you know, that's an ethic. It's just a different one.
Dan, here. Several of you had mentioned how being here at Holden, you've been able to bring your spirituality and your sexuality together, or you're able to come out. And it got me thinking about my church in St. Paul, and we're currently having a lot of discussion about becoming a church reconciling Christ. And I'm wondering how, and you may or may not be able to answer the question, it's for anybody, how you've thought about being able to take what you have here at Holden and bring it back to where you live and kind of make the bridge, if we can call it that.
You guys are going back sooner, so.
What do you think, Mike?
And it could also be something that, you know, we could take back to our church in terms of, you know, what we've learned here.
It's hard for me to respond in terms of taking something back to my church because I don't have a church back home.
Mm-hmm.
But I can talk about my college and that kind of community.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. We have a club at PLU called Harmony, which is like a gay lesbian pride club that does a little bit. But we also have this counterforce of fundamental Christian clubs that have a lot more people and have a lot more influence in the school. And in response to something you said earlier about people saying Christianity is like oppressive, and I can relate to that because a lot of the Christianity that I witnessed growing up was, I saw it as oppressive, and to, at least to me personally, because I felt like it wasn't of homosexuality, so I, for a long time, just thought that Christianity was just bad and would never work for me, sort of. And that's kind of reinforced the PLU through these clubs that they have. So I guess what I would try to do is just to get more dialogue going on between these clubs and to the more general population of the school. It's hard.
I'll put in a plug for another forum we're having tomorrow at 3:45, which is also called Sharing Our Stories, but it's people in the Holden community who are parents of lesbian and gay children. And when we talk about reconciling both congregations, and there's some similar movements in each denomination, I always think of my parents, and often parents say when we come out they go in the closet. My mom has passed away, but when she died, my dad in his grieving process told me how hard it had been years previous to that when I came out to them, and it took a couple of years and then they became comfortable being out and talking to other parents. But in that period when they were struggling with it, my mom would go to her ladies' circle meetings in the church. And the other women in her circle, who she'd known for many years, would talk about those terrible homosexuals, knowing that, well, you know, there's not going to be any in our circle. But my mom had this secret, and Dad said she would come home and cry, and you know, we it's not only us but our brothers and sisters and increasingly friends and parents who are hurt and abused by those sort of attitudes in the church, and I don't, part of this cultural shift is we were brought up to think there are certain categories of people that it's okay to abuse, and we're opening that up, and I think it's making our call to the gospel, even with other religions, it's like we might have a different point of view, but certainly we're called to be loving to everyone. We're learning how to do that in new ways. Many of you probably come from RSC congregations. Yes, sir.
Two quick points. I really would be supportive of what you said about parents coming out with, and the importance and the significance of those, of that. The parents that have associates and friends, and they know them and respect them for this to come out. And there is, as you well know, parents in very high places in the church that have gay children. So I guess I would hope that there could be more encouragement for that to take place. The second thing I briefly mentioned, I was in World War II in the Navy for 4 years. And if you want to get a feeling of what the emotions were during that war, just ask yourself what your life would be today if the Germans and the Japanese had won that war. There was a time when, even though as big as we were, it was in, so what it did, it cemented servicemen's feeling and escalated patriotism like this country hasn't since had. Unfortunately, with that was this anti-homosexual that was so embedded in everyone who we were sharing and risking our lives together. That resulted in a tremendous bond of feeling anti-homosexual, just because it's equated with patriotism and this. I mention it because this generation is pretty much out of the way. Those that clearly won that war, they're pretty much, I happen to be 77 and still around, but there are most of them young. And as that generation passes out fully, I think that there will be much more comfortableness about the people. I already see in my grandchildren and in my children a different feeling, a completely different feeling than I recall the feeling that a serviceman had put on us by military. I mean, I'm claiming the military, it was just part of the times. So I'm hoping that the environment will change and keep changing. It won't be a perfect environment, but it's not a perfect environment for us right either.
Two quick responses that brings up just an historical note is that although we often talk about Stonewall in 1969 as the beginning of the modern movement, it actually happened during World War II when GIs were convicted of gay and lesbian behavior in the WACs and the WAVES and the. They were discharged, dishonorably discharged, and an H was stamped on their papers for homosexuality. And they tended to be let off, if they were Navy or WAVES, they tended to be let off and discharged in San Francisco. And that was the beginning of this community. And you still had to, it was during the war, and you still had to have that identification card. And so community developed, not so much around sexuality as around the oppression experience by people of a variety of sexualities. And the other thing your story reminded me of was, and I think it's about how this impacts straight community as well. When I was the chaplain at San Francisco General in the AIDS ward, a nurse came to me and said, there's a man in the chapel an elderly man, and he is sobbing down there all by himself. Would you go down and talk to him? And I did. And the story he told me was that his best friend since high school, and he was probably late 60s, those two men had gone fishing every summer for a week in Northern California. And the last time they were together on their last fishing trip, his buddy, since 17, had told him he had cancer and had been given a year to live. And he cried in the boat when he told him. And now he had died, and the man had been there as his best friend died. And what he was weeping only to God about was that when that man told him through tears, I'm dying and I'm afraid, will you hold me? He couldn't do it. He couldn't reach out and care because straight men don't do that. And now he regretted that. And I think that's part of this too, is just releasing the whole society from this grip. That's homophobia, where you know your desire just for common human affection can't come through. How strong the mores, the cultural mores. Someone who hasn't talked yet.
I was thinking that the question was really to you people, what you could do. I think that there is a lot that those of us who are not homosexual and don't have a homosexual in our family can do much more easily, because we're not defending ourselves, we're not defending our families. And I think that every one of us should be brave enough to talk to our pastors, to talk to everybody in our church, make an opportunity to talk to our especially the people who are homophobic. They need to hear it. They need to hear that God created these people, and he loves them, and we must love them too.
It goes up very much along what the lady here had said, and to your question, you had mentioned that when your mother would go to her sewing circles and they would talk about those nasty homosexuals, and assuming, as with all prejudice, it's us and them, and there must be something different about them, and the ending of that prejudice very often is when you meet someone of that category and know them as a person. In my congregation that I attend, I very recently, in fact, weeks before I came here, a couple of weeks, came out to my congregation publicly in an evening. And that was the start of a conversation within the congregation that I was amazed at how the Spirit of God used that so many people came out. You were talking about how people came out as Christian, you know, to your big friend. We had a man in our staff meeting that the Wednesday after this who collapsed in tears, a very elderly man, and said, I had a gay son, and he was dying of AIDS in 1986, and our Lutheran pastor would not commune him as he was dying. And so went and found another pastor in another Lutheran congregation who would, happen to be the former pastor of our congregation. And this man has terrible guilt, 15, 16, however many years later that is, that he had mistreated his son and had turned him out, and he feels guilty that because he turned him out, he acquired AIDS and died, and it was his fault. And our pastor said, well, did you have PFLAG? Did you have, you know, anything? And he said, we were afraid to even ask for any help because, well, why are you asking these questions about, you know? I think that as we can, it's just relying on the Spirit of God to raise up those prophets, if you will, who will be willing to share that story the first time. In that staff meeting, we also had a lady who came out that her daughter was dating a black man. We're talking about 2002. But she was legitimately frightened to share with our Midwestern Norwegian Lutheran congregation that her daughter was in an interracial relationship. And she felt free to share that because I had been willing to share what I had said. That was a great test for me to do that. A very close friend of mine, whom I loved very dearly, had often talked and let me know that he did not care for homosexuals. He's an elderly man. And I loved him as a person and just chose, like you said, to not make my sexual identity a part of that issue for a certain period of time. I talked to him before the service took place. He's an elderly man. He's not well. I didn't want him to be shocked and have a heart attack when I said this, and I said, Jerry, this is the way it is. This is who I am, and I know how you feel about gay people. And he says, well, he says, I'm not happy about this, but I love you, and so I guess I'm going to have to figure out how I'm going to deal with this. So even those who are so adamant, at least in my life, are at a place now, as you talk about in this most postmodern time, at least somewhat willing to look at an individual and know them as a person. And it's those conversations, I think, that will get this going.
I think many of us are willing to stay and just continue, but I promise that at an hour, we would have an opportunity to leave without feeling rude. So if you'd like to leave, this, you can do that now or later. And we could feel feeling a little bit, so we can continue.
I think the issue that the church everywhere needs to deal with, and that people can take back to their congregations, you were interested in taking back some ideas to your congregation, is that, you know, society tells us a lot of things to do that are bad, but the church we look to tell us how to be good people. And the church, many people believe, tells us that it's okay to do bad things to homosexuals, that it is a sin. And because it is a sin, it's okay to talk down to this person and ultimately kill this person, which happens. I think what we need to say when we're dealing with congregations is to have a bottom line where the discussion started. The bottom line is that very good biblical scholars on both sides of this issue, who have devoted years and years to research, disagree. So we can't know the answer. And therefore, we can't know that one way is wrong and one way is right. We can't condemn a person. We do, the Bible, I think people would agree that the judging part is wrong. And by saying that homosexuality is wrong, after all these studies have shown that people can't really find that in the Bible, they disagree on it, then we're judging to say that it's wrong. We, not God, we are becoming the judge. And the Bible, people would agree, tells us not to do that. Again, bottom line has to be that good Christians and good biblical scholars disagree, so we can't know at this point in time a final answer. Imagine they said the same thing about slavery.
I think we probably will never know a final answer in this life. I mean, obviously, when we come into being as in Christ's likeness in heaven, we will know.
But you said such a wonderful thing about you decided personally, and I think a lot, that's wonderful. But a lot of people decide what's personally right for them means it's wrong for this person, because this person isn't. That's where I see problems occur. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I speak to my congregation and say, I've decided this is a sin and it's wrong, mm-hmm. it's telling people it's okay to hate them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's better that than a millstone be tied around your neck.
Yeah.
I just think it's also important to understand that you can decide that it is wrong and still love the person, like David was saying. And I think that as a general title over whether it's Christian groups at PLU or anywhere, that maybe they don't agree with that act. They may think it's a sin, but it is still possible to love and have a deep care for people. And I mean, I'm going to love the person sitting next to me because they're a sinner. Everyone's a sinner, but it's still just a matter of giving out that love of people, being Christ-like.
Yeah, I think that's what we need to take back to our communities, is to show them love.
It's a hard thing, though, and I want to take seriously the whole, like, love the sinner, hate the sin argument. It's a dangerous one. I'm not saying, I want to kind of talk about this as openly as I can, but it's a dangerous one to do. I'm kind of a deep Lutheran on some level. I believe that we are all sinners. I don't really believe that that has much to do with my specific action, whatever that is. Like, it does, but it doesn't. There's a lot that I give over to God as understanding. Like, God understands this more than I can understand it. The human terms and the human language I'm given to understand this, I don't understand. I think that, I guess, what am I trying to say? There's a lot that you're talking, what I'm listening to, when I hear the hate the sinner, love the sinner, hate the sin, hate the sin, I want to ask really carefully, so what's that sin? What are you talking about? What are you talking about? Are you talking about a sexual act? Are you talking about all the things that are connected with all of the kind of cultural prejudices that may have some truth and may have little truth, like promiscuity. We think gay. We think AIDS. We think we think unhappiness. We think broken families. We think We think child molesters. We think children who are abused. We think all these things. Whether any of these have any factual connection to homosexuality or whatever you're gonna call it, those are things that are kind of connected onto this thing. And so I guess that's what all I want to say. I hope I'm not offending you by the way I'm responding to this. It's more I just want to say that love the sin or hate the sin argument. I want to say what are you really talking about in that sin? And is it really okay for us, even as human beings, as Christians, to start making a list of our own of what that sin is? What sin is in general? Is it okay for us to do that? Is that our responsibility?
We can't do it for other people.
And there's a lot of answers to it. I don't have the answer, but...
Just related on the same thing, just a different vein, the love the sinner, hate the sin. Love the sin, yeah. our church tried that. I'd love to see I'm curious about what that looks like. Our church tried that with a man who was an elder in our church, who came out, we're going to love you, but you can't serve communion.
Yeah.
You really shouldn't be in the choir anymore.
No.
And you really shouldn't be any, but we love you.
Sure.
But so I'm real curious as to how that.
When I came out to the pastor, he said that I could no longer be a leader to the children.
Yeah, so you know, how does that get played out? Besides all the other points which I think are good, like the same church tried to create a list of sins in terms of leadership. You know, you can be, they no longer have the line in the sand that you have to be straight. So anybody can be a member, but to be a leader, you have to be committed to celibacy or marriage and not be certain kinds of sinners. And the dialogue was great because materialism was listed, but homosexuality was really described. But this guy goes, okay, I need a better definition of materialism because we're about ready to buy an SUV. You know, if I can't be a leader here and have my SUV, I don't know.
I'm kind of watching in order of hands going up.
People have their stories about going to their pastor, and when I came out to my pastor, I wasn't questioning my belief because I was very clear about what I believed, and I feel in the minority because I have been able to develop and maintain my own understanding of my own sexuality and also my spirituality, and have not had to go through some of the struggles that a lot of people have. But one of the things that Bob Follow said to me was, he said, well, you know, he said, the great commandment that God gave us was to love one another, and he didn't tell us how to do it. And that was kind of Bob's way, you know, those are kind of the little things that he would come up with and say. But that was the most freeing statement to me, was the fact that God, you know, we weren't given a direction book, and we weren't said, you know, it wasn't said in the Bible, men, you know, don't love women or don't, you know, or have sex with women but not men. In fact, one of the things that I really appreciate about, is it Peter Gomes' book? Peter, is the fact that the reason that men having sex with other men was thought to be sinful was because one of the men had to act the part of the woman, and that was what made it sinful. So I think there's always to look at things, but as a Christian, the most freeing thing I think that we can look at is the fact that God told us to love one another.
Back to the whole love the sinner, hate the sin. In terms of my older sister's a lesbian, I'm going through that whole issue with her. It's really difficult to separate the sin from the sinner. I mean, is that I mean, if you're going to call homosexuality a sin, that's who my sister is. That's her life. She has a partner now, and they have a daughter together. And I can't separate just here's my sister and here's the lesbian. I mean, it's every aspect of her life, so you can't. That's my...
I think historically, especially in the church, why there was such a struggle to get to the point where we could have the sign up that's in the snack bar about preference. Ice cream flavor is a preference. Mm-hmm. Sexuality is an identity, or whatever it says, is the, you know, your kind of basic definition of sin is choice. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to, somewhere in there, it's to be sin, it has to be choice, and then we can repent the choice we made. And but especially in the context when the movement was starting, and it's in the context of things like gender liberation and racial liberation, you know, we don't think of, you know, someone's skin pigmentation is not a choice, therefore it's not a sin. And many of us experience our sexuality as, you know, as far back as I can remember, prepubescent. You know, I can look back now and say, oh yeah, this is who I am. And that's not a choice. I mean, I can't choose not to be who I am. More and more now, the discussion is, the parameter of that discussion for the is being moved to be like, well, why even bother with that question anymore? But that's part of that postmodern modern thing. Like the modern question is, is it a choice or not? The postmodern question is, why are we even caring about that stuff anymore? But anyway, that's just sort of a historical note. And you're right, like your sister's example. I mean, I had to come, part of the biggest emotional push for me to come out to my parents was that with each passing year, it was getting harder and harder for me to explain my life to them. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I was making choices about what city I was living in and my committed relationship and why I was leaving the Lutheran seminary and going into the UCCs. You know, all of these had one answer which could not be spoken, and so all of a sudden I'm getting more and more alienated from my family because I can't tell them, I can't talk on the phone about what's going on in my life. And that's sin. You know, the old Paul Tillich thing about sin is alienation. And so what's causing that alienation in relationship is the opposite of the old classic definition of just act.
I think it's hard to go back out into a congregation. I think you have to be a pretty damn strong person to be able to stand up to some of the pressure that can be put on you or put on a person to deal with this. If you are pro-gay, you've got to be pretty strong in it to stay in a congregation and say, this is right. And you know, somebody said somebody made the comment about loving your neighbor or something like that, and you know, that seems pretty vague to me. I want something pretty concrete. And one of the biggest gifts I ever received was in a meeting where somebody started telling a fag joke, and a man that I just have some casual relationship with, he stopped it right there, you know, and at that point he moved up quite a few notches. But I also know that to go back out and to speak out and to stay strong with it is a challenge.
I think you're right, Dave, and I really agree with you. And the thing that I think the advantage that I had in my congregation was I'd been in the same congregation all the time growing up, and by the, and I never officially came out and said, well, look at me. It was just kind of, it became kind of an understood. But the thing that's been really interesting for me, it's fun to hear you guys talk about PLU, because Dave and I were classmates at PLU, and there were actually guys that were kicked out of PLU because someone reported that they were gay. And this was in the 70s. So it's pretty amazing. But one of the things that I think happens is that we show, by example, we can say our identity is that we're, you know, gays or lesbians, but that's just a one part of right. who I am. It is not my only identity. And I think a bigger identity for me is the Christian part of me, and the way that I treat other people and the way that I expect that to be an example. And your story, you know, about the guy telling the fags or stopping that. I remember my godson went to PLU and played football there, and I was waiting around for him one time, and there were a bunch of guys making fun of this other man because he was gay. And Peter's response was, you know, you guys are really jerks. You know, how don't you feel sorry for this guy that doesn't get turned on by breasts and doesn't get turned on by the things that you see in women and think they're beautiful? He said, what's the matter with you? You know, just because this, he gets turned on by, I mean, I didn't really quite agree with a lot of his argument, but the point was, this was my godson who had, you know, known me for the 21 years of his life and known other people, and he took a stand to stand up for someone because of, not because of any discussion I don't think he had with people that he knew that were gay, but because he had watched that and been around it all of his life, and he knew that that was what, it was his responsibility to do. So I think it's, I mean, I love your history that you do, Dan, because you think back and realize how much better things are than they used to be. But it's like the attitude. I love the attitude where the guy goes, "Hi, I lowered my cholesterol. Hi, I lowered my cholesterol." It's like, I don't want to be the one who goes, "Hi, I'm Chris Larson. I'm gay. Hi, I'm Chris Larson. I'm a lesbian." I don't, you know, I. That's part. I mean, it's like, you know, Christopher doesn't come up to me and go, "Hi, my name's Christopher, and I'm a straight man. I'm a straight heterosexual man." I mean, you don't do that. You know, I don't think about my lesbian friends and wonder how they make love with one another any more than I think about that of my parents and think, gee, I wonder how they do it. It doesn't identify who they are. I don't want to think about it.
Okay. As you're saying that you don't want to have that part of you be that first, you know, thing. Do we have to have that then too with our churches? Now, with the issue of becoming a reconciling Christ church, or just having in our constitution that we are open to all people, and also among lesbian and homosexual, for gay men, do you really feel that you want to become and be part of a mixed church, or do you feel, you know, to be guys you have been doing and setting up, you know, gay and lesbian churches or homosexual churches. You know, so how do you feel about the idea of churches making that extra effort? Because that's some of the problems we had to deal with. Like, well, why do we have to make this extra effort? Why can't we just say we're open to everybody and that's fine? Do you feel that a church needs to make that extra effort for you? Or do you feel you can be part of a mixed church? Do you feel drawn to a church with all of your same peers?
Yeah, I think the church needs to make an effort. Yeah. It needs to make an effort, like, now. It needed to make an effort, like, 20 years ago. And it's part of the age that we're in. Like, you know, you could say this should have happened in the Civil War, but really, like, civil rights movement, like, not so long ago, you know, like 1960s, and not so long ago, the beginning of the women's movement, and really not so long ago, the gay and lesbian movement. Like, these are movements, I mean, the 20th century just kind of rocked us all with these movements of, no, we do need to put some effort into very particular people, because that is the age that we're in, and that I feel like, you know, I'd love it if maybe a century, but probably it's going to be more like 5 centuries from now or longer, that we would be at a point that we could all say, we are a people that are open and accepting and loving of all people. I don't think we, as a social, as a socially constituted humanity right now at this point, can do that. I don't think we know what that means yet. I think that we need to say, no, I, as a pastor in this church, or I, as a congregational member in this church, support African-American people being part of this church. I think that as a member of this church, I support this gay man and his daughter being a part of this church. I, as a member of this congregation, support this interracial couple and their child who is of a different race. I support, like, all of these very particular things, because I don't think we get it yet in this country. I don't think we get it yet in the church. And so that sort of specific, like, I think the Reconciling Christ movement, like, yeah, it needs to happen, because people are still getting killed. People are still...
Without it, it's just lip service?
Yeah, right now, like, people are still, like, because I've thought about, because even though it's 2002 or whatever it is, like, I thought, when I had, like, you know, the little rainbow sticker on my car, and as I was driving as a woman alone in a car through the United States, I thought, I wonder if this is safe for me to be doing this. Yeah. Because I'm camping in my little tent on the side of the road, you know, or in whatever. And, you know, because I think that, and I'm a person that hates fearing that sort of shit, you know? I hate that. I don't live out of fear. But because even part of my mind thinks that, and because I've heard so many stories from so many people, and they're not stories that happened 20 years ago, they're stories that happened, you know, last week. Because of that, yes, I think we do need to do that.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah.
I think it needs to happen, because of things like what Dan was talking about with his mother's experience, that it was clearly an okay thing in a ladies' circle at church for them to talk bad and down about homosexuals as if it was a sin. So if we don't have these conversations within our congregation and congregations and decide how our church and our church leadership is going to respond to it, clearly people still think that's okay to judge in that way. And that makes it a not open place for people to be.
And I think, I'm assuming the Reconciled in Christ program is the same in the UCC. Our program is called Open and Affirming, but the denomination has stated that it hopes all congregations go through the Open and Affirming process, and it's not just a vote, it's a 12-week process where the congregation goes through a study and is encouraged to talk, hear things like this great panel, and, you know, get into it and then vote out of the, hopefully going through a process that has transformed them and brought some of these things up. So it's a process
that you're going through a transformation, and sometimes it's difficult. Growth always is, I guess. We have tons of it. Let's just go right there.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, reconciling Christ churches, though, our churches, where they have gays and lesbians and straights, right. Not just gays and lesbians. And so I don't think that's the big problem with it, because there are a lot of people that are not gays and lesbians who are in these congregations and are very much fighting to make them, to make everybody welcoming. But I think there's another thing that I'm really concerned about. And I think that our churches and our Christians who are against gays and lesbians, our pastors who are against them and so forth, are really criminals. We are causing young people to commit suicide. A lot of young people who have been committing suicide are people who have concern about their gender issues. And when we think that, at least used to say, that if somebody committed suicide, they couldn't be saved. We don't say that anymore, I don't think. But I think that is still somewhat a thought. So we must be careful that we're not making young people kill themselves. And I think we are criminals.
Because killing somebody who's a criminal is not going to change his heart.
No, but I think that the churches should be teaching people to love everyone, and certainly teaching them should take a stand that we are for these people. We are not against these people. God created them, and God loves them, and we love them too. And then they wouldn't have this terrible feeling about themselves, probably.
So then how does the church do that after centuries and centuries of telling people that it's okay to discriminate against homosexuals? You know, how do we make that change? What are other trends that have happened in the church that have helped us to make that sort of change? How do we break through that?
We have to teach. And I think we have to know. Now, when we talked about the women's circle reading the book, our circle read a book. And when we discussed the book, there were 13 of us in the circle, and 5 had a relative. 5 had a gay relative. There are so many more than we know about. And I think that that's one of the things, we have to give people enough guts to come out, and whether it's their relatives or who, that they are willing to say it. And then I think with more and more people being willing to admit this, that we have it in our family or this or that, it'll change too.
We've talked a lot about sin, and I want to answer your question. I grew up in the Pentecostal church. My grandparents were Pentecostal ministers. My parents were also ordained in that denomination, one of those denominations. And I have heard every sin and every sermon on the vice list and Romans 1 and Leviticus that you could ever care to hear. And I don't want to sound Pollyanna talking about my positive experience with this gentleman a few weeks ago, because when I came out to my mother about 6 years ago, we've not spoken since then. The reason why I feel that this reconciling in Christ, or whatever you call it, is so important is because, and why you have to say the words gay people are welcome in this church, is because we have heard for our whole lives everybody is welcome but you. Whether it was stated explicitly or implicitly, there is that feeling amongst any of us who've had any even close brush with Christianity. And our friends who, like Miriam talked about, our gay friends who have nothing to do with the church, have that perception too. I was at Gay Pride in Phoenix and saw a man wearing a t-shirt, and I almost cried when I saw it, because it said in big red letters, "Jesus, protect me from your followers." Mm-hmm. And that is a sad commentary on the Church of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. So I feel Jesus said, what did he say before he left? He said, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature." And when we're telling them everybody but you, because you're of a different color, because of your of a different race, because of your whatever, you're not in this group, I think we have completely denied this by grace through faith. faith that we preach so heavily. I think it's interesting that we even have this discussion about ordination or participation in congregations by gay persons in the mainline denominations, because as we search the scriptures, Jesus said not one word about homosexuality, but he condemned divorce very heavily.
Yeah.
And my former pastor had two wives and was on his third, and went on to be the assistant to the bishop of another synod. And no one, so I find the argument so hollow, so shallow, that we're even discussing why they can't be.
That's right.
Why do we quantify sin? Why do we say this sin is worse? If you've ever been in an altar guild meeting, there is more gossip going on in that place, and that is at the top of the vice list too. And we don't tell those people they can't be in that
place. Brotherhood too.
I was just going to add, the other reason why we need reconciling churches for gays, lesbians, bi, trans, and straight people, because if you're straight and speak out and stand up for people who are gay in a church that's not accepting, then you're never bashed as much as gay and lesbians are, but condemned too, because you just are. I think starting the conversation in churches is a great thing to do. And as I started that conversation in our church, there were people who were after my head as somebody that needed to be off session and no longer an elder, because I would lead people astray. So just like the young woman who left, who was asked to no longer teach in the youth group. So that's why we need reconciling churches that are accepting of all people.
Dan, one of the things that happened in my experience, but it's just kind of a fun story, because when I came out to my dad, and he was dying, and he told me a story about two of his good friends that were a lesbian couple, and I didn't really come out to him, but he was kind of saying to me it was okay. But anyway, when I came out to my mom, she didn't do quite, I mean, she wasn't quite as bad as your mom, and crying and being circled when the women would talk about gays and lesbians or whatever, but she really struggled and tried to figure out what to do. She finally went to the campus pastor, and he and his wife spent a lot of time dealing with her and talking with her. And then 11 years later, their daughter came out to them, and they came to my mom for counseling. And it was really interesting, because my mom and this couple had become very, very close. And the latest event that took place in our church when I was there, in my home church when I was there, was the baptism of this young woman and her partner had a little boy, and they baptized the baby in the church. And her dad is a Lutheran pastor, and he was convinced the church was just going to fall apart, that they wouldn't be able to stand this baptism going on. And it actually turned out to be a wonderful celebration. But but I think that we're going to keep evolving, and I think things will continue to change. But I just love the fact that they came to my mom, who had gone to them 10, 11 years earlier.
Another thing that helps, I think, is to bring people from outside in to make a speech or something, so that it's not that risky anymore. And in the Lutheran, in the ELCA, that's more and more people who have been in a prominent leadership are starting to do that. When I told my story about coming out to my bishop at that time was Chilstrom, who became the president. And part of what made me so angry was that his son, who was my age, who I knew, was gay, and they knew that, and yet they were living in this hidden shame thing. And now that he's retired from being your presiding bishop, he and his wife are traveling around to churches telling their story and sort of repenting for the lie that they told the entire Lutheran church.
Sins of omission.
Through how they were, their silence. And they could come to your church, you know, to invite them to talk about what that was like for them. How much better it feels to be open and honest now.
She's speaking at Baltimore 2002 at the Lutheran Concerns Conference. Sure.
The latest bishop, I just want to say this, the latest bishop of the Minnesota district immediately came out for gays and lesbians this last year. So our new bishop is not waiting till he retires. He did it right away.
Ma'am, did you want?
I just wanted to say that I'm very sad for any of the folks whose parents have not accepted them. They're missing out on a great deal. I have a lesbian daughter, and I was very complimented and felt privileged when she trusted me enough to share that with me. And through her, I have learned so much. I have met such wonderful people, and I can't say too much about PFLAG as being a wonderful resource for any individuals or families or congregations. They have speakers that will come, and that will help to put a personal touch to the situation that so many find so problematic.
And I think part of the strategy of what we can do as well is just turning those tables. And last week at the end of work camp, everyone wrote here at Holden, everyone wrote these evaluations that then go through the administration so that we can improve. And my partner, John, had pretty much organized all the different work groups and ran around inspiring them to keep working each day. One of the evaluations that came across my desk was, you know, see the note on the back when you turn it over, and there's this whole page of hate written about, you know, I'm a Christian, and how can you possibly have a homosexual in leadership at this Christian retreat center, and condemnation, just on and on, and then in this terrible lifestyle. You know, and I'm reading this thinking, what is Christian about this hatred that you have and that you feel somehow your religion privileges you to spew all this hatred and condemnation, and you know, we should be kicked, they should be kicked out of here, and, you know, on and on and on. And, how can, when we confront that in our congregations, you know, is there a lifestyle of hate or something? Or I just think of one of my seminary professors saying, you know, if Jesus and the Buddha were to meet, would they have a fist fight? No, they would have a really interesting conversation, and they would be loving toward each other. That's, you know, going across the chessboard to this issue, it's like somehow that's the bottom line. I mean, where we were a little earlier in the conversation about, even if we disagree, you know, it's not a license for hate, and that's what someone brought up, the suicide rate. I mean, the statistics are very clear that suicide among teenagers is all about this issue, or this. And this Reverend Phelps in Kansas City, who travels around to people's funerals, you know, God hates fags, and your son is going to hell, and in the name of Christ does that kind of stuff. And, you know, that's the issue.
And I think what's then interesting, I mean, hard, but then interesting, is So where do you go with that? Where do you go? What's the next question? Okay, what is this fear about? Like, what, when you have that conversation with your congregation, with individuals, with people, like, get at what the fear really is. You know, get at that, because until you get at that fear, you're not going to get anywhere, because the fear is real, but nobody really knows what it is. And it's actually, it's probably a lot of different, really interesting things that need to come out, need to be talked about, you know, of, and for specific individuals, that fear is going to be different. But I think that a lot of this is rooted in a kind of a socially undefined fear and a very complex, re-understanding of identity in a modern to postmodern world. We are as a society, and we are as individuals here in the United States, most of us in kind of at least a middle class existence. We have enough, and we have enough time to think a lot about ourselves. Like we are trying to constitute our identities in such in new ways, and we see society around us kind of playing with constitution of identity, you know. And I mean, everything, like, it's this wonderful, like, a part of my identity is Christianity, a part of my identity is lesbianism, is this and that. Like, gosh, it's such amazing language, and we're still trying to figure it out. But I think that is a part of a lot of the fear that's out there. Like, what is this? What's up? What's down? What's right? What's wrong? Because we're kind of turning this over. So, I don't know.
I think we have to be careful with the hatred that is brought with the letter, for example, that we don't in turn be hateful towards that person. And instead, you know, if you choose to pray for that person, that they can rid themselves of such hate, that that's a lot more helpful and actually more productive. And the other comment that kind of goes along with that is that it's been brought up a couple times, the number of suicides of homosexuals. And I think you also have to be careful there in not blaming people that are against homosexual behavior or homosexuals or however they want to define it, blaming them for those suicides, because that's just going to get them to become more defensive, and it's not really going to get them to move anywhere. So it's kind of hard for me to hear that you know, their suicides are blamed by another person's acts.
Well, it might not be another person's acts. I think
it's the society.
So, and then we as individuals have to take responsible for this social thing that's happening. I don't think anybody's saying, like, this
just
one person.
No, not but, one person, yeah. But to some extent, because you also don't want them to push away and say, oh, they're blaming me for, like, the 50,000 people that just committed suicide.
Yeah, like,
you know,
this doesn't get very far on my personal journey to love. Yeah,
exactly. And I'm not saying that those people were not in a lot of pain when they committed suicide, and that it wasn't up to those issues.
Yes, I think we're fighting not flesh and blood, but principalities and powers. Mm-hmm. And sleepiness. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys.
Thank you.